This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and happy June. In honor of what is typically the last month of the Supreme Court term, I want to talk about the biggest cases that the Supreme Court has heard but hasn't ruled on yet. So this is going to be a preview of the end of the term. I want to mention right off the bat that I'm not going to include all the activity that's happening on the so-called emergency or shadow docket, because that is ever-changing, never twice the same, and we've actually covered a number of those cases in other episodes. Today, I'm going to devote myself just to the big merits cases, meaning those cases that were set for briefing, were set for oral arguments. The court got all the briefs from the parties and friend of the court briefs, amicus briefs. The court also heard typically at least 60 minutes, generally more, of oral arguments. They then went back behind closed doors. They had their conference. They decided who was going to write the opinion, who was going to write if there's a dissent, if there's a concurrence. They traded drafts. And soon, typically this month, we will get all of those big opinions. As listeners know, I love this time of year. I love waiting to find out how the court rules on some of these major cases that in big and small ways affect our daily lives. So let's dive right in. I want to start with what is actually the last case that was argued before the court, and it wasn't set in a normal session. So the court extended its typical time for hearing cases for oral arguments, and it set a special session on Thursday, May 15th, to hear Trump versus Washington, New Jersey, California, meaning this is the case dealing with whether or not federal district courts have the authority to issue universal or nationwide injunctions that block federal policies across the entire country. Meaning what? When people sue and they go into federal court, maybe it's a person, maybe it's a group, maybe it's a state, can that federal judge say if the issue is whether or not an executive order can be implemented? Can the federal judge say that executive order can't be implemented, but just as to the people in the courtroom before me? Or does the federal judge have the power to say that executive order, at least for the time being, can't be enforced anywhere in the country? That's a nationwide or universal injunction. Now, as many of you already know, this case arises from challenges to Trump's executive order 141-160, and this is the executive order in which he tries to redefine birthright citizenship by limiting it to children born in this country with at least one parent who is a U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident. I'm going to offer to you that I think the executive order almost certainly, in my view, certainly violates the 14th Amendment's citizenship clause. Now, three cases were filed, and in three cases, the district court judge issued a nationwide injunction. The Trump administration has said that that is improper, that that's judicial overreach. It allows a single district court judge to halt federal policies nationwide, and that it's the executive branch that instead should have the authority to implement policies without facing these nationwide injunctions. On the other hand, the plaintiffs in this case, they say that nationwide injunctions are necessary in order to stop widespread constitutional violations and to make sure that we don't have a patchwork, that there's a national standard. They also say, particularly when it comes to executive orders like this one, that there could be harm to thousands if the executive order goes into effect, even in part of the country. Now, after oral arguments, I have to be honest that I'm not sure exactly how the court's going to go. I think I do count about five justices who think that nationwide injunctions should be banned because they exceed the scope of judicial power. As you all know, all you have to do in the Supreme Court is to count to five. So that could be enough for a ruling that says nationwide injunctions are improper. The reason I have pause here is because, frankly, I don't know if the justices want to make this decision in this case, meaning there have been a lot of cases dealing with nationwide injunctions that don't have to deal with an executive order about birthright citizenship. And I do think that if not all, at least 8 of the justices think this executive order is unconstitutional. So my pause here is, I don't know if they want to say no nationwide injunctions when they're dealing with an executive order that, frankly, I think flies in the face of the Constitution. But of course, we need to remember that whatever the court's ruling is, it will apply far outside of this particular executive order. It's going to apply, we suspect, to every other situation when somebody challenges an executive order. So that's the really big case that I'm watching. And of course, there are other big cases as well. So let's go to the next case. This is called Scarametti, and it was argued back in December 4th. This deals with a Tennessee law that bans certain gender-affirming medical treatments for minors. And the question is whether or not that violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. My prediction is that the Tennessee law will be upheld. The court will say something like it's neutral in application because it prohibits everyone, regardless of sex, from obtaining these medications for the prohibited purposes. Now, a little bit more background here. Back in 2023, Tennessee banned medical providers from providing certain puberty blockers, hormone therapies, and gender-affirming surgeries to minors, and this means people under 18, when meant to support a gender identity different from their sex-assigned identity at birth. Now, these same treatments are allowed for minors when used for other medical conditions, like precocious puberty. Violations of the law can result in fines and legal consequences for healthcare providers. Now, what are the parties' arguments here? Well, the plaintiffs, 3 transgender teens, their families, and a medical provider, say that this Tennessee law discriminates based on sex and transgender status. That it denies transgender kids medical treatments available to other kids, and therefore it should be subject to a heightened type of scrutiny, and that it violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause under that level of scrutiny. Now, the defendants, Tennessee, says this is a neutral restriction aimed at protecting minors, so you use a lower level of review. Again, in this case, I think what we need to look for is what is included under sex-based discrimination, what standard should be used, and of course, the big question here, can states restrict gender-affirming care for minors? And I think that the court is going to say that they can. One little note here is that there's another 14th Amendment case kind of lurking in this particular case, but it's a question that didn't go before the Supreme Court, at least not this time, but I think it might come up to the Supreme Court at another time. And that's whether under a different part of the 14th Amendment, the Due Process Clause, whether or not there could be a right for parents under the word liberty, whether or not liberty protects the freedom of parents to say, I want my children to be able to obtain this type of care. So that's an issue that's not before the court right now, but I'm just flagging for everybody that I think that could come up at another time. So let's move on to some other cases here. And these are cases dealing with discrimination claims and what standard should be used for people trying to prove discrimination. Let me explain. The first case, the Ames case, Ames versus Ohio Department of Youth Services, was argued on February 26. And in this case, the issue is whether a member of a majority group, typically meaning a white person or straight person, has to show, quote, background circumstances to support the suspicion that the defendant is the usual employer who discriminates against the majority, end quote, in addition to showing other elements of an employment discrimination claim under Title VII. Let me put this a different way. What standard does a plaintiff who is a member of a majority group have to prove? What do you have to show in order to win on a Title VII employment discrimination case? My prediction here is that the challenger is going to win, which, as I'm going to explain, will mean that all plaintiffs, regardless of whether or not they're part of a majority group or minority group, will have to satisfy the same standard in their employment discrimination cases. So a little bit of background here. There's a straight woman who works for the Ohio Department of Youth Services, and she alleges that she was denied a promotion and later received a demotion, that it was discriminatory based on her sex and sexual orientation in violation of Title VII. In this case, a gay man filled her position. Now, the lower court here, the Sixth Circuit, the Court of Appeals, said that a member of the majority group who's suing based on an employment discrimination claim under Title VII has to show more than a member of a minority group. Again, they have to show additional evidence that the employer here discriminates against the majority. And that's the test that I just quoted, that background circumstances test. Now, in this case, what the plaintiff is arguing is that all discrimination, all employment discrimination cases should be subject to the same standard of proof when they're making their initial case of discrimination. This is about making the prima facie case of discrimination. And what they're arguing here is that background circumstances, that additional requirement, that additional standard of proof, it imposes an unequal burden on plaintiffs who are members of the majority group. And my suspicion after oral arguments is that the court will agree that the challenger will win and that all plaintiffs, again, in Title VII cases will be subject to the same evidentiary requirements. And this could lead to an increase in what are so-called reverse discrimination claims, meaning claims made by members of a majority group. Now, there's another case that deals with discrimination claims, and this is AGT versus Osea Area Schools. This was argued in late April. It's a newer case in that way. And the question is, does the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act require children with disabilities to satisfy a uniquely stringent, quote, bad faith or gross misjudgment, end quote, standard when they're seeking relief from discrimination related to their education or educational services? So again, we have another case dealing with what standard do you need to satisfy to bring a discrimination case, but it's in a very different context here. Here we have a student who has severe epilepsy. In her old school in a different state, in Kentucky, she received in-person instruction from 12 to 6 and at-home instruction at night. At her new school in Minnesota, the school provided in-person instruction from 12 to 4:15. Now, what happened here is that there was a violation of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. The parents then filed a lawsuit under the ADA and the RA, that's the Americans with Disability Act and the Rehabilitation Act, seeking compensatory damages for that discrimination. The district court said that the school district wins that case because it applied that standard that's very hard for plaintiffs to satisfy, bad faith or gross misjudgment. Now, the plaintiffs here, the petitioners, AGT and her parents, say that this standard, bad faith or gross misjudgment, it creates an unfairly high burden on students with disabilities. They say that there's no basis in the text of the ADA, and courts should apply a lower standard, the deliberate indifference standard. The respondents, the school in this case, says that the bad faith or gross misjudgment standard is needed to protect them. Essentially, that it's needed in the educational context to prevent costly lawsuits and protect states from liability based on good faith decisions. Oral arguments in this case became incredibly tense, and I think that I counted at least, I think at least five justices to say that they were skeptical of this higher standard. So if the challengers win, as I suspect that they will, and if the court adopts this deliberate indifference standard, then students with disabilities would have to satisfy a lower burden of proof in discrimination claims. Now I want to turn from the discrimination context in filing employment suits and suits in the education context to talking about religion. And specifically, there are two cases that are outstanding dealing with the kind of tension between the two different religion clauses in the First Amendment. One of those clauses is the Free Exercise Clause, which very generally says that the government cannot burden one's ability to practice their religion. And then on the other hand, there's the Establishment Clause that says that the government can't establish an official state religion. Again, I'm being really general here. Let's deal with a case out of Wisconsin. This is Catholic Charities Bureau versus Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Commission. Now, the issue here is whether or not a state can deny a religious exemption from the state employment tax based on the fact that the religious organization, here the Catholic Charities Bureau, doesn't meet the state's criteria for religious behavior. Or does the state's denial of that religious exemption from the state employment tax, does that actually violate the First Amendment religion clause? So let's do a little bit more detail because I know that issue statement is really a mouthful. So Wisconsin law exempts organizations that are, quote, operated primarily for religious purposes, end quote, from paying into the state employment system. Back in 2016, the Catholic Charities Bureau asked for an exemption from paying into the state unemployment system and instead wanted to join Wisconsin Bishop Church's unemployment pay program, which is a church-run alternative. Wisconsin denied that request, saying that the Catholic Charities Bureau services are primarily charitable and secular, not religious, and therefore they didn't qualify for the exemption. Now, my prediction here is that Wisconsin is going to lose and that the Catholic Charities Bureau, that means, would win and that they would be able to get this exemption. Now, the Catholic Charities is a social ministry arm of the Diocese of the Superior in Wisconsin. Now, since 1917, the CCB has provided services like in-home health care, housing for the elderly and disabled, childcare, employment assistance. The CCB says its mission is to serve the needy and that that is a religious obligation rooted in Catholic doctrine. And what they say is that the state's criteria for determining who can get this exemption from paying into the unemployment, that the state's criteria improperly favors religious organizations that proselytize, and that that amounts to discrimination against faiths like Catholicism that instead emphasize service without evangelicism, and that this amounts to discrimination against faiths like Catholicism that instead emphasize service. So the CCB is arguing here that denying the exemption infringes on the church's autonomy and that it improperly entangles, this is a key word for a lot of these cases, the state in theological determinations. Now, the Wisconsin Labor and Industry Commission is arguing that CCB's activities are secular, and so they don't qualify for that religious exemption. They say the exemption actually aims at trying to prevent entanglement by excluding organizations whose activities are not overtly religious. And they're arguing here that giving the CCB this exemption would blur the line between church and state. During oral arguments, I think there was a lot of concern over Wisconsin's criteria for determining what actually constitutes a religious activity. You heard, for instance, Justice Kagan questioning whether requiring overt religious practices like proselytization unfairly discriminate against faiths that express their beliefs through service. So I think the implications here is that a ruling in favor of the CCB, the Catholic Charities Bureau, could broaden the definition of religious activity for tax exemption purposes. And again, I suspect that that is where the court is going to land. Let's talk about another case dealing with religious rights. And this is a very different case. It was argued back in April and April 22nd. And the question here is whether or not public schools that require elementary school children to hear books about LGBTQ people to participate in instruction on gender and sexuality. The issue here is whether or not public schools that require elementary school children to listen to books about LGBTQ people, or more broadly phrased as participate in instruction on gender and sexuality, that goes against their parents' religious convictions, whether or not they need to provide parents with an opt-out provision. And if they don't provide that opt-out provision, if that violates the parents' First Amendment Free Exercise Clause rights. So maybe put another way, do public schools infringe on parents' First Amendment rights? Here we're talking about the Free Exercise Clause, by mandating that elementary school students get exposure to LGBTQ inclusive materials without offering opt-out provisions. In this case, my prediction is I think the school board will likely lose and the court will find that an opt-out for parents is required under the Free Exercise Clause. So let's talk in a little bit more detail. In 2022, the Montgomery County Public Schools introduced several LGBTQ inclusive children's books into the elementary curriculum. This is aimed at promoting diversity and inclusion. Parents were notified and originally allowed to opt their children out of lessons involving these books. Fast forward a year and the Montgomery County Public Schools revises its policy and they eliminate the notice and the opt-out option. And what they say is that it was creating serious administrative challenges. It was potentially stigmatizing LGBTQ students and increasing absenteeism. Now, a group of parents sued, challenging the local school board's revised 2023 policy. And the parents are arguing that, again, the lack of opt-out provision infringes on their First Amendment Free Exercise Clause rights. Because what the school, meaning the government, is doing here under their argument is compelling children to hear books and content that contradict their religious beliefs. Now, the school board has said that the curriculum is neutral and generally applicable, that the purpose, again, is to foster inclusivity and respect for diversity, and that allowing opt-outs would not only create administrative challenges, but that it, again, could potentially marginalize or stigmatize LGBTQ students. Now, my prediction here is that I think the parents likely will win based on the oral arguments. Again, predictions are always a dangerous business. And this would mean that the schools, in not just this school, but schools nationwide, would have to provide some sort of opt-out options for lessons conflicting with parents' and students' religious beliefs. Now, I think the real question for the court will be how to write that opinion that doesn't allow for a really, really broad opt-out, because obviously I think the justices will be mindful of not wanting parents to be able to opt their children out of a lot of different types of instruction and information. So again, we have to wait to see how broadly or narrowly that opinion is written. And of course, we still have to wait to see what the ultimate outcome is. So I think those are the really big cases that I wanted to talk about. There's another case where there's a question about whether or not U.S. gun manufacturers can be liable for violence in Mexico committed with firearms that are trafficked from the U.S. We can go into that in more detail, likely at another time. My prediction is that Mexico is going to lose and that there will be no liability for U.S. gun manufacturers. There's another case that's a fairly complicated redistricting case out of Louisiana that we've already talked about a little bit. I think I'm going to get into that particular case after the decision is made. Right now, what I hope you have is a preview of some of the biggest cases that the court heard and the questions that were asked, my predictions for how I think the court will go, and enough information so that when the cases do come out, hopefully you have the context that's necessary to figure out exactly how these cases will affect our daily lives. As always, this isn't the end of the conversation on the Supreme Court. We are going to bring you more as the decisions come out. For now, as always, please rate, review, and subscribe.